Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The Billy Bennett Achilles Director of Keyboard Programs here at Stanford University, George Barth did his undergraduate work at Wesleyan, then received his Master of Fine Arts and Doctor of Musical Arts degrees from Cornell. Specializing in the music of a number of composers, including Beethoven and Ives, Dr. Barth performs and teaches the piano. His students include now the Thomas and Barbara Stevenson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Condoleezza Rice, who served from 1993 to 1999 as Provost of Stanford University, from 2001 to 2005 as National Security Advisor to President George W. Bush, and from 2005 to 2009 as the 66th Secretary of State of the United States, always finding time to practice. George, Madam Secretary, welcome. By the way, we'd better establish,
please.
We've known each other for a while.
So it's George and Peter, a lot of years.
All right.
That's right.
Why does it matter? Why does it matter? I said, I mentioned a moment ago, 2% of classical music school, music sales, 2% of music sales. You go into a gym here at Stanford University, Stanford, best students in the world. And what have they chosen to put on the speaker system as people work out? It ain't Mozart.
To be fair, Peter, I don't work out to Mozart either.
Oh, you don't?
No, I work out to Led Zeppelin.
Oh, but, really?
Yeah, I
oh,
do.
Maybe
I do.
That's the problem with my regime. So you have given a very substantial portion of your life to this endeavor. Why?
Classical music is one of the highest forms of the arts that human beings have ever achieved. If you look at the complexity of what these great composers were able to do, you wonder how the mind was able to create this. And we have to stay connected to this marvelous music. We have to stay connected to this heritage of this highest art form. And I understand that it's not popular, but not everything is popular. We still have to preserve it, we have to perform it, we have to play it, we have to try to introduce our children to it. And one of the ways that we do that is to make certain that we keep the arts in the schools and we keep the arts in a sense of a broad education. I know there's a lot of talk these days about STEM and technology.
Yes.
But there's nothing more human than what these composers were able to do.
George, the piano in particular, this instrument achieved substantially its present form by about 1860 or so. And by the way, my instructor in this is you. I get all this from you. So the two of you are sitting, here we sit in the middle of Silicon Valley, no microchips, no lasers, no plug. You are sitting at a mechanic of wood and wire and ivory that achieved its present form a century and a half ago. Why is this instrument not irrelevant?
The very reasons that Condi outlines, I think we see, I think about at Stanford, people come here having perhaps no background in classical music, very intelligent. By the time they leave, they're deeply embroiled in Haydn's string quartets. They find it, they hear it, it begins to have a place in them. They see something about the dedication of the professors that they work with here. They see what fascinates us, they hear it. Others, of course, come with amazing backgrounds. I mean, our studios are always filled with students who've studied 13, 14 years and are extremely adept, most of them measuring in neuroscience, biology, computer science, but they too have set aside a great deal of time to work on these instruments. It seems as if it's endlessly fascinating stuff that we found. I mean, I got an email from a grandnephew of mine who was writing to me about why he had never become involved in classical music. And he said, it seems too complex. I said, what are you listening to? He said, Mahler symphonies. I said, don't start there, you know. Granted, Mahler symphonies are mighty complex. But again, as Beethoven said, they need to hear it more. And as soon as they hear it more, it's introduced to them, then, you know, this fascination begins.
How did it, by the way, as you were playing, I have to say I had forgotten, watch classical music on television, listen to it on iTunes or Spotify, or come here, as I've done several times in it. sit here in the concert hall, but I know the two of you. And so I was reminded somehow, because I know you, what a neurologically amazing feat it is that one of you can hit the right notes at that speed, but that the two of you can work. There's some, it is just an astonishing thing that happens. But it's hard, and you have to start early. Take me to the Rice household back in Alabama. Who persuaded you to start playing?
Well, I was very fortunate. I come from a musical family. My mother, my grandmother, and great-grandmother were all pianists.
Oh.
And my mother was a wonderful pianist and church organist. My grandmother was actually classically trained in South, right, in the early 1920s.
How did that happen? That's extraordinary.
It's a kind of a mystery to me, too. She was the daughter of an African Methodist Episcopal preacher, or bishop, actually, very high up in the church. And he somehow found this Viennese master to teach his daughter piano. And so she learned to play very young. She taught piano lessons, and while my parents were teaching school, I would stay at her house from age 3, 4, 5 until I could go to school, and I wanted to play. Her kids would, she'd come over, they'd have a piano lesson. She charged 25 cents a lesson. And at the end of it, I would go to the piano and I would bang at the piano. And my grandmother said, finally, Angelina, my mother's name, let me teach her how to play. I think she wants to learn to play. I was 3. And my mother said, don't you think she's a little young? And my grandmother said, well, we're going to find out. And so I actually never remember learning to read music, which I do think is an advantage. Mm-hmm. Because reading music, particularly piano music, is quite complex. You have 2 hands, you have 2 clefs. They're moving this way and that way simultaneously. Yes. And by the way, if people want yet another reason to play the piano, the Schumann that will be heard during this video, I played with the Omaha Symphony a couple of years ago, and I realized I had to memorize the score because you can't really play with the score. And a few weeks later, I was talking to the head of neurology here at Stanford, and he said, you memorized that score? And I said, yes. He said, you have no idea what you've done for your neuroplasticity. So for all of us that are looking for agelessness, learn to play the piano. But I started very
young. We're getting tips. I just want to keep track of them. Yeah. Work out to Led Zeppelin, memorize Schumann.
Right.
It's a complicated life you lead.
It is, it is. But my mother, then they let me learn to play the piano. And there's one great story. My father said, I said, I need a piano as a 4-year-old.
Oh, you didn't have one in
We didn't have
home.
One at home. We had a little organ, you know, one of those little play organs for kids.
Right.
And I said, I can't play all the notes that I need on this little organ. So my father said, okay, when you learn to play What a Friend We Have in Jesus perfectly, we'll buy you a piano. My grandmother said that the next day at her house, I sat there for 8 hours. I wouldn't even have lunch. When they came back, I knew What a Friend We Have in Jesus perfectly. And my parents had to go out and rent a piano because they couldn't really afford one. But I'm lucky to have been exposed to music, classical music, very early.
So can you remember, all right, that's an unusual story. Even at that, a lot of kids will start fairly early, and then they'll something, by the time junior high comes along, sports kick in, they'll drop it.
Yeah.
Or they'll go to college and drop it. Right. Was there a moment when you knew, this is a keeper for me, this is going to be part of my
life? Well, there
was
a moment when I almost dropped it. At age 10, having played for now 6.5 years or something, I went to my mother and I said, I'm quitting. I'm tired of playing the piano. And my mother said, you're not old enough or good enough to make that decision.
Wow.
And so I kept playing. And when I've had a chance to play this great music with George in his studio, or to play with Yo-Yo Ma in Washington, or play with the Omaha Symphony, I look toward the heavens and I say,
Thanks, Mom,
for not letting me quit.
George, what was your story? You grew up in Pennsylvania, as I recall?
Yes, one of 5 kids,
right.
And everybody played piano. And apparently,
why was that? Were your parents musicians?
My father grew up in a very poor family and never had money for that. But he taught himself one tune, which I can still hear in my mind. My mother did study. Her family was better off, and she studied. And they just thought it was something that every kid needed to have. We also sang together always. You know, we did lots and lots of part singing and stuff.
You did as well.
Yeah, we did as well.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So. You know, everybody in the family was going to do the piano, but apparently by the time I was in the high chair, I was like trying to get at the instrument. They would put me up there, and I would listen to my older sisters play When I was, I guess, about six, my brother taught me some boogie woogie, which I thought was great. And then they allowed me to start lessons when I was in first grade. And I worked with the same small town teacher, an amazing woman, incredibly generous. After a time, she said I was on a scholarship, which meant free lessons. She bought all my music. She sent me to Tanglewood and to study with her teacher, Stanley Hummel, who was a student of Levine. So, you know, these were amazing opportunities that I had. Nevertheless, I never intended to do this professionally. I went to.
How did that? By the way, there's in both of your stories, there's someone just in the background who's sacrificing, which I don't think you probably realized at the time, but there's someone just off stage, so to speak, who believed it was so important that they were willing to go to considerable trouble to make it happen. That's fascinating, which you now, there really is a kind of, you feel, you both feel yourselves in a kind of chain of obligation in a certain sense. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's all of these great stories.
It's a very happy obligation.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like, guess what you get to pass on, all this beautiful stuff.
So at what point did you say to yourself, at what point did you know that this would be a vocation?
It was very late in the game.
Oh, was it?
I was at Wesleyan, I think I had about six majors. You know, I would sort of travel from one to the other. And somewhere in late in my junior year, I thought, you know, the only thing you've been doing consistently is music. And at Wesleyan, that meant gamelan, American Indian vocal music. I had no history of music. I remember asking Dick Winslow there, you know, is there like a harmony course? He said, harmony? Read a book. Of course, I was a strict non-reader, so I didn't do that. I mean, Wesleyan was a wild place in those days. But I, you know, there was something about this strange background, and my teachers, John Barlow at Wesleyan, Peter Armstrong, fascinating musical presences. I couldn't let it go. And I finally became so obsessed with playing that by the time I was a sophomore, I was already teaching. And when I was a senior, they asked me to stay and teach. So I stayed there 11 more years and taught. And then after that, went to Cornell.
I wasn't aware of that gap. So you've been teaching music from the get-go.
I had made a vow never to go back to school. But that ended after I met Malcolm Bilson from Cornell.
So you're practicing the piano while working in the White House. You're practicing the piano as Secretary of State. Now, I'd like to probe that very odd notion a little bit. You're known as a person of unusual accomplishment. I mean, that's not subjective. That's just anybody would agree to that. Also, as a person of unusual discipline, I think that's generally the case. But there's nothing about a sort of dread sense of duty that I pick up when you talk about the piano. What were you getting out of it? Why did you make the time when you were so busy?
I have to. George and I crossed paths because as he was committing to piano, I was leaving it, of course.
Right.
Because I had decided at the end of my junior year that I was about to end up, you know, playing in one of those department stores while people shopped, and so perhaps I'd better find something else. I'd gone to the Aspen Music Festival School and met real prodigies, and I thought, oh, I'm really okay, but not that good. And so I went back to college at the end of my junior year, found international relations and decided to go that direction. And so that's why, of course, ultimately I would end up Secretary of State, because I made the switch. But in between, I finishing college and going to graduate school, mm-hmm. I played actually very little. I taught piano lessons to make money for graduate school because it was better than waiting tables. Only barely, but better than waiting tables. And then I was here as provost. And in 1993, as provost, Paul Brest, who was then dean of the law school and plays the viola, said, you play the piano. My chamber group would like to play some of the chamber music with the piano. I said, Paul, I haven't played serious music in years. But I started playing a little bit with him, and I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. And I went to George Barth. I said, who's the head of the piano department? I'd just become provost. I said, who's the head of the piano department? They said, George Barth. So I called up Professor Barth, and I said, I'd like to come see you. I want to take piano lessons. So maybe he wants to tell you his reaction, because he's since told me.
At the time, I thought, they're trying to get rid of me. This is kind of a trap, you know. But actually, she was serious. And then at first, of course, I've mentioned this many times. I thought, probably just dilettante. So I, you know, we worked on a Chopin Nocturne. And then she said, I want to devote more time to this. And
because,
by golly,
of course,
she
time
did.
Is weighing heavy on your hands as provost
right,
of Stanford
right.
University.
So I realized that she wanted real criticism at the highest level. And I thought, okay, let's see how this goes. So
then we played. I was going to play with the Meir String Quartet that fall.
And the Brahms F
Brahms
minor quartet,
F minor
which is
piano
one
quartet.
Heck of a piece. So,
yeah.
So we set to work on right. that, and it was a wonderful performance. We worked.
Was there one lesson when George just let you when you could tell he was taking you seriously?
Oh, from the very beginning,
oh,
he
really?
Was taking me seriously. I'd play about four bars, and he'd say, No, wait here. Let's do that again, and let's think about this. But that Brahms, the wonderful thing about it is it's a bear of a piece yeah. for the piano. It really is, and we would work 2 hours, 3 hours at a time on mm-hmm. this piece, 10 hours a week.
Yeah.
And you, in life, you have to find things, you have to find time for things that are fulfilling for you. And for me, these were, in many ways, the most fulfilling 2 or 3 hours of the week, because people say, well, it must be relaxing. Well, it's not actually relaxing,
no,
struggling
with
Brahms. It's really
right.
hard work. But it is transporting. When you're playing, when you're practicing, nothing else can be in your head. And that was the secret also when I was National Security Advisor, Secretary of State. Even if you're trying to relax and you say, I'm just going to sit here and read a book, or I'm just going to sit here and watch a television, your mind is spinning. When you're playing the piano, there's no room in there for anything to spin. And so it truly does get you completely away. And those 8 years in Washington, I found a chamber group to play with, mostly very fine musicians who were no longer professional musicians. And they were wonderful because they didn't care if I was Secretary of the Moon. They just wanted their pianist
around. Is she
around.
In time? Right.
Right.
Got it. So this is a crude way of putting it, but I'm trying to get it. Again, I'm still on this question of what it did for you, what you got out of it. Did it enable you to serve as Secretary of State? Better?
It
were you a better Secretary of State because you were playing Brahms?
It was absolutely a part of keeping my balance, keeping my center during all of the troubled times, keeping my center. When you're Secretary of State and you're at the top of a food chain, so to speak, you can also lose a sense of who you were and who you are and that kind of core. And music, maybe because I started so young, maybe because I associated with my mother and my family, it's core to who I am. Mm. And in those times, you have to hang on to things that are core to who you are. Mm.
George, you've been at this a while now. So let me ask about the nature of music as a profession. And so here's a spectrum of professions. I know a lot of guys who went into finance in the island of Manhattan at about my age. And roughly speaking, they learned everything they needed to learn technically about their markets in about 9 months, and then spent a couple decades piling up loot, and then were very happy to get out of Manhattan at the age of 45 and drop it and find something else to do with their lives. Okay, that's one where the profession, you can get to the bottom, so to speak, of what you're doing with your life professionally fast. Mm-hmm. Other end, we know that Michelangelo was working with a hammer and chisel until a few days before he died at the age of 88.
Yeah.
He never felt he mastered his art. He never got to right. the bottom, never all got all the way down.
Yes.
How is it with you?
It's the latter, certainly. I mean, I was learning basic things at 40-something. I mean, that's just the way it goes. Partly because I never attended a conservatory, and I needed to sort of get everything by hook or crook. You know, just who would know this? You know, who could I find that could tell me about this problem? And I found a lot of very intelligent musicians who could teach me things, but I'm still doing that. I mean, I have a very inspiring colleague, Kumaran Arul, who's, it seems like every week, he opens new visions for me in terms of musical ideas.
This is, the nature of this enterprise is not that you reach a point in which you say, oh, I've got it.
Well, maybe some experience that. I mean, I know that certainly some, you know, there are some pianists who seem to be almost born with natural affinities for the physics of it.
There are prodigies. There are prodigies, kids who can Well, Mozart, right. we know that such things exist. Yeah.
And yet Mozart said he had to work very hard in Vienna to do what he did. I mean, so, and, you know, it's...
I don't think this comes easily. Yes, there are people who are more natural than others, but we know the story. You told me the story once of, I think it was Rachmaninoff, and someone came to his studio. She was going to study with him, and right. She was very excited, and she's standing outside the door, and she hears someone going... And she thinks, oh my goodness, he takes beginners. And she walks in and it's Rachmaninoff. He's just trying to make sure that the sound of each of those pitches is exactly as he wants it to be. Mm. And that is in some ways the challenge of this. I love it. I'm trying to recapture some technique and move forward in things that I never did well. And sometimes George will say to me, well, you know, I'm still struggling with that too. And I think, yes. So it's, you're always struggling, I think.
I want to, at some point soon, I'd like to get out of the way and just watch the two of you work together. But first, composers. You've mentioned Brahms. And I know from reading up on you and from talking to George that you just love Brahms. And if I may say so, Brahms seems to me an odd hill on which to make a stand. Bach, way at the you know what it is. It represents a world, an oral world unto itself. Mozart, of course. Beethoven, of course. And then on the other side of Brahms, you've got real romantics, people who are really just wonderful tonal experiments, Chopin, Debussy. But Brahms, yeah. Madam Secretary, is neither one thing nor the other. He's kind of stuck in between this classical world where form is everything and the romantic world where it's subjective and impressionistic. He's just stuck there.
I'd obviously put it a little differently for my favorite composer.
I ask you to rise to the defense of Johannes Brahms.
Brahms obviously cared a great deal about classical form. And that's one of the things that I love about Brahms, is this effort to bring back the discipline of a Bach or a Mozart. And when you look at what he did, it's remarkable that you can compose within that discipline.
But to he saw himself as a reinventor of a tradition.
Well,
in part,
he extended that tradition because, of course, he was in a period in which all of this expression was possible, in which these modulations and harmonies were modulations and harmonies that you find even anticipated in a Mozart or Beethoven, but taken to their fullest extent in Brahms. And the really interesting thing is that he died in 1897, so had he lived a few more years, he would have experienced the 20th century. And I find myself all the time wondering how Brahms would have experienced 1910 or 19, because he anticipates some of what you will see in Schoenberg, even. And Schoenberg wrote a very famous article, Brahms the Revolutionary, in which he lays claim to Brahms as someone who was already pushing the envelope. So I actually see Brahms as someone who took this classical tradition, this what some might have experienced or thought of by the time Brahms was composing as a straitjacket. He didn't think of it as a straitjacket. He thought of it as enabling then him to push this forward and move it forward. And you look at some of the harmonic and rhythmic uses that he makes, elements that he, and it's just extraordinary. Brahms is also, for me, passionate without being overly sentimental. And I rather like that.
That's your formula.
That's my formula.
Got it. Okay. That one clicks for me. Now, who's your current... Are you still... Brahms is still your man?
Brahms is still my man, yeah. I love a lot of composers, but I have to tell
George
you...
George claims he's got getting you interested in Ives.
He is, because I was not really introduced to Ives as a music major or really since. I laugh with George that I was taught by a German who thought that after the Germans there wasn't much except maybe a few Austrians and, of course, Chopin.
Ives is early 20th century American.
Right. Okay. And the American composers were way at the bottom of the list. And so George, who has been really exploring Ives and bringing him back to life both through performance and through his writing, his musicology, I said, George, I want you to introduce me to Ives, and so he's promised to do
that. So, George, if I may say so, you too have some defending of yourself to do. Ives, this assonance, eccentric, very odd stuff, You who are a champion of Beethoven, you know.
Beethoven wrote very odd stuff too. It may not sound odd to you now, but it certainly did then. I mean, people were baffled by Beethoven. So, and he said they need to hear it more, and that's what I've said too. The entrance for me, and this is an interesting aspect.
You remind me
of
Mark Twain's comment on Richard Wagner. It's better than it sounds.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead. Sorry, that was.
It's all right.
Just count on me to lower the tone.
Yeah, right. No, but I the thing that interests me about Ives is that even though as his life went on, he began to have a kind of obsession with adding dissonance in certain respects. His work with dissonance, very early in the 20th century, was already extremely unusual and advanced and very complex and deeply considered. One of the things that my students are astonished at is to discover the methodology that was behind much of what he wrote. And in some cases, it's extremely rigorous methodology in pieces that you can hardly believe there's methodology. And then when you realize what he's done, you see, okay, this is the way he would test himself. I am going to, and he had very exact parameters of what he needed to do to see if what his ears could do with that, right? So he was a man who could actually play and sing everything that he conceived of. He could hear it all, which is astonishing given what he did. At the same time, there were things that lived in him that were Victorian, simple, touching, harmonious things, right? They were always there. He said there's no reason why music needs to be all atonal or all tonal. Let it all be here, right? He wanted to somehow encompass it all. So when I'm introducing people to his music, I take them in through the door of some of the simpler things, and I say, this is what he could do, you know? This will be comprehensible to you, and it's also scintillating or touchingly beautiful. And now, you know, come along a little further and see where this goes. And you know, some of it takes a long time. I remember when I was learning to understand Concord, the Concord Sonata, which is each movement is named for one of the transcendentalists that interested him. The Emerson movement opens it, and it must have been 2 or 3 years before what sounded to me like complete cacophony began to make some sense to me. That was a long time, you know.
Sure. So again, I want to watch the two of you work together, but one more question along the lines of, well, I don't know your politics, and actually I like it that way. Let's just not talk politics. But I know that Condi believes in free markets. So does it shake you a little bit? Does it shake your faith in free markets that the markets don't really reward this endeavor particularly? As I said, that classical music is 2% of the marketplace. I mean, even, and this is nothing new, Mozart died virtually bankrupt. It was a kind of flair, in a certain sense, it was almost more celebrity than a deep appreciation of his music.
Well, Brahms, by the way, did very well, thanks to a piece that he hated, the Brahms Lullaby, so. Oh. But look, markets operate on information, and sometimes information is imperfect, economists will tell you. And I think information is imperfect about what classical music really can provide. And that's why I think it's so important to introduce kids to it. It's important to bring it into the schools, to bring students here who perhaps don't know it when they arrive but find it compelling. I just have to believe that when people really have a chance to encounter classical music, they'll buy it.
Okay, so one more question along those lines. It was thought, I put that in the passive voice, I'll put myself in the middle of it. I thought, a lot of people thought, 10 years ago, a dozen years ago, as first CDs came along and then the internet, iTunes, Spotify, and so forth, that we have this wonderful democratization of music. You know, we're a long way from having to get dressed up in an evening gown or a dinner jacket and go to Carnegie Hall to hear classical music. You can download it at the touch of a button. And I was among those who thought, people will find it. It's so powerful, it's so beautiful, it's so compelling. We stand at the very beginning of an age of a kind of rebirth of interest in and appreciation of this music. And it just hasn't happened that way.
Well, I would give you two reasons for that. One is, first of all, entry to it isn't that easy. And I don't know that entry has to be easy for everything in life. Sometimes having to work at something's not a bad thing. Sometimes having to read great literature, even though it's not immediately like the plot line that one finds on a half-hour sitcom. There are these great arts that take a little work sometimes. And so I think getting kids introduced to the arts in a way that allows them to access them rather than just sort of dumping it at them is really very important. Secondly, I do think that we may underestimate the degree to which people go online and maybe they just listen to one piece, maybe they hear one performance. And finding a way to capture that is not so easy. But I suspect that there are more people who hear this music in one way or another, maybe if it's even in a movie theme or something, than we suspect. But we have to do a better job. We have to do it in the schools. We have to do it in places like this. We have to make it available. And I still think people will learn to love it.
George, are you fighting, are you a champion of a lost cause? Do you feel that your students, there is some slow dawning that may be taking place, or does it simply not matter to you? You feel called to play your music and you will play your music.
Yeah, lost causes are delightful to me. I think, you know, that all the best causes may appear to be lost. That's neither here nor there.
I love this man, don't you?
Yeah.
The things that fascinate me about what's happening on the popular scene in terms of people's listening habits among my students. I mean, my students are fascinated with this stuff, but their listening habits include all the popular stuff. I mean, they have an enormous array of things that they listen to. Game music, right, fascinates them. But the other thing that's happened because of, for example, YouTube, you know, when I was in college, if I wanted to hear Friedman's recordings, I had to find somebody who went to somebody's basement in Indiana and found this old tape of an old recording. And you know, now they're all over the place. So my students are beginning to play. These influences are coming at them from 1910, you know, 1920. They're hearing rhythms, they're hearing colors, they're hearing approaches. In particular, they're hearing a kind of spontaneity that had been erased by some of the stuff that happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s of the last century.
Do we have Brahms? Do we have Brahms playing?
We have a single recording of Brahms playing that was heavily damaged. But actually, one of my colleagues, Jonathan Berger, has resurrected it through electronic means. He's discovered that you could pull a tremendous amount off there. And one of the coolest things that we learned is that many of the concepts of how Brahms should be played are apparently wrong. The rhythms that we're discovering are Hungarian for him were different than the ones that we thought were supposed to be there. Also, his playing is a lot wilder than anyone had expected. Incredible rubatos, dashing stuff.
And oh, she's going to like him even more now.
Yeah, this is, absolutely.
I mean, this is
we talk
great
about
news.
This.
This is great news.
Yeah.
Really, the early recordings contain.
So the technology, you know, in some basic way, is still on your side.
It's the technology is opening marvelous things. I mean, we now have this new project we're doing, the Player Piano Project at Stanford. We purchased one of the largest collections in the world, the Kahn Collection. We brought 7,500 of the reproducing piano rolls. We have 10 instruments and now more. We're getting the instruments back in shape and we're listening. You know, you sit there and you listen to Rachmaninoff play in front of you. So this is
by way of this technology, we can hear the way Rachmaninoff played Rachmaninoff.
Yes, yes. There are, I'll say there are caveats, complicated caveats, as there are with early recordings acoustically. Likewise with these piano rolls, you have to know how to listen. But the best of them are astonishingly beautiful, amazing experiences.
Wow, okay. Listen, the two of you worked together, but you were on the committee. I want to hear about these instruments. You were on the committee, as I recall, that chose these pianos when Bing Concert Hall was opening, correct?
Yes, my colleagues went off to New York and to Europe to choose them. I was not on
specific,
those journeys, but
what we have here are two Steinways.
Yes.
And dab eye that I have for music, I can tell this has a matte finish and this has a glossy finish. But this is a Queens, New York Steinway, and this is a Hamburg, Germany Steinway. Right. What's the difference?
I mean, in terms of traditional sense of the difference, I would say the sound objectives are different. The European objective is a beautiful, beautiful surface. Warm and pliable and rich. The American thing is guts, you know. American Steinways, the best American Steinways, sort of they come from inside and get you. And, you know, to some degree, I think there's been so much transatlantic communication that, you know, maybe that's less palpable now, but that was certainly what many of us experienced over the years, is the difference between the European and the American ideals.
It's also wonderful. Every piano is different. Every piano is.
What do you have at home?
I have a Steinway. I have a New York Steinway.
Beautiful.
I also have a Chickering in another house because my parents gave me that Chickering
Chickering is sort of 19th century.
Yeah, but my
American,
parents gave it to me when I was 15 after winning
a
concert.
So treasure,
I have both pianos, but what I love about it is I just love that every piano is a little bit different. They all have their own personalities, and that's also really fun.
So what are you working on?
Well, we are working on the Beethoven Spring Sonata, which I play with a very fine violinist, a violinist of the Meyer String Quartet, Peter Zasovsky. And so we're working on the Beethoven Spring. We're also going to work on some Chopin over the next few months, the Chopin F minor Ballade. Which,
are you getting ready for specific concerts?
Well, no, the Chopin I just want to learn. Okay. When I performed for my junior recital in college, I did the G minor. And at 17, the G minor, I just had to do the G minor. Now I wish I'd done the F minor. At 60, the F minor feels like the right one. So I'm going to do that. And then we're going to work on some Ives. But we've been working quite a bit on Beethoven. And so if you'd like,
I'll walk away, and I'd like to hear how a lesson, frankly, my first question is, if you're the teacher, what do you say to a former Secretary of State if you'd like her to a little more brio?
I'm actually not the former Secretary of State in his
not
studio.
Not in his studio?
No.
Okay. Say whatever you need to say to help the music along.
So I'm going to get up and walk away. The two of you give us 3 or 4 minutes of a lesson, and then then play the piece to get us out. I'll stroll back over here to thank everybody for watching, but I'm getting out of your way right now.
So, great. I see a couple of things. Every now and then, there's still a little bit of a where the note that's on the odd-numbered segment is a little shorter, and it will sound more peaceful if those are a little bit wider. Mm-hmm. In other words, opposite. Let's try just from your tune in bar 11. Okay. Yeah. It's not that the tempo needs to be slower.
Yeah.
It's just that the relationship between the note lengths needs to be turned around to the ti da di da rather than ti da di da.
Yeah.
There. Let me just take a look at that for a moment. That's it. Easy on this.
Yeah.
Sometimes at the top there's some tension. You can see it in your
wrist.
The wrist and so on. Ease into it. Even the shoulders coming up. Not too fast. Mm-hmm. I'll play with it.
Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State and Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, George Barth, Professor of Music and Director of Keyboard Programs at Stanford University. Thank you is insufficient, but thank you. For Uncommon Knowledge from the Bing Concert Hall here at Stanford University, I'm Peter Robinson.